fingerprints as well. Wrong. Wrong. I must have confused you. By doing the dishes, I meant that I put the dishes in the dishwasher. I heard some people gave the dishes a quick rinse before placing them in the dishwasher, but this always seems silly to me. If the dishes aren't clean after their first go-around, you do a second. I ran a load once, after eating only peanut butter and jelly for a week, 11 times. Ethan said, "You said before that the victim filleted the fish. True. Then why aren't her prints anywhere on the knife? Maybe you've heard of this thing called Teflon. Many consumer products are made from this material, like the handle of the fillet knife, for instance. Teflon, by virtue of its slipperiness, repels oil and would make a fingerprint nearly impossible to come by." Was this guy still cooking in clay pots? He nodded. Point Prescott. I wasn't done. "And if you look at your little print out there," he picked it up, "those fingerprints are on the blade." I mimicked picking up the blade with my thumb and right index finger. "That's how I picked up the knife and set it in the dishwasher. You don't grab a knife in that fashion if you intend to use it to take someone's life." "That's not to say that you didn't handle the knife by the handle. You said yourself that Teflon repels oil, so fingerprints would be hard to come by." "Actually, I said impossible to come by." "Regardless, technically, you could have handled the knife without leaving a print." My friend Ethan was starting to piss me off, and I mentally took an invisible 2x4 out of my pocket and smashed it across his face, which, surprisingly enough, made me feel much better. He was about to start talking, and I interrupted him. "But," he raised his eyebrows. I leaned forward and said, "That knife that you have a picture of," I paused so he could pick up the printout, "isn't the knife that was used to kill Riley." He looked at the image. Erica leaned over for a better look. I'm not sure either of them bought what I was selling. Ethan said, "And why exactly do you think this?" "For one, those prints are set in fish oil." Fish oil was thick, and it had sheen to it. I continued, "Can we agree on this much?" Erica said, "We'd have to run a test, but I'd say that is accurate." Ethan gave her a harsh stare, but he too seemed to concur with this analysis. He said nothing to contradict this statement. "So if my prints are set in fish oil, it's safe to say that these prints were imprinted prior to the death of the victim." Erica nodded. I looked at Ethan. After a long pause, he nodded. I continued, "Look at the amount of blood on the knife." "Not much at all." "Barely any, actually." Erica's and Ethan's faces were just inches from the document, nearly touching. They both surveyed the knife for a long minute. Erica said, "You're right." Of course I was right. I added, "The victim died from a laceration of the neck, more accurately, the carotid artery, which we all know is the biggest artery in the body. I mean, look at the crime scene photos. There's blood splatter 6 feet from the body. How then is it possible that there is almost no blood on the knife?" "No, if this knife was the murder weapon, there would be so much blood that those perfect fingerprints of mine would be long gone." Erica was smiling. Ethan was stewing. In case I hadn't already convinced the pair, I said, "Also, if you look at the size and shape of the laceration on the victim's neck, it isn't consistent with the knife found under my sister's mattress. The knife that killed the victim was serrated. Fillet knives aren't serrated." Erica shuffled through the photos until she found the close-up of the laceration. She looked up. "You're right. There's too much blood coagulated near the wound. If this was the knife used, it would be much cleaner." "That a girl." Ethan took the photo from her and returned it with the others. He said, "Well, that's enough for today." He left the room for a brief moment, had a quick conversation with a man in a suit, then returned. He had a piece of paper in his hand. He walked behind me and said, "Thomas Prescott, you are under arrest for the murder of Riley Peterson." Erica's eyes bulged, but she said nothing. Evidently, there had been enough evidence to convince a judge to sign an arrest warrant. I couldn't really blame them, but I did. I turned to him and said, "If you think I'm going to jail, you're fucking crazy." He laughed. "I want my phone call." "Sure thing." He gave a quick chuckle, and he and Erica walked from the room. A moment later, a uniformed officer pushed through the door with a phone. He asked me the number, and I told him. He dialed and handed me the phone. The cuffs made it difficult to talk, and I was forced to hold the phone up to my ear using both hands. I had a minute-long conversation, then handed the phone back to the officer. He left as quickly as he came. 10 minutes later, Eric and Ethan strolled back in. Ethan had a shit-eating grin on his face and asked, "So who'd you call?" "My lawyer." "You get a kick out of that?" "Oh, I can't wait to see this guy." He picked up his blue Powerade and shot a stream into his mouth. He kicked his legs up on the table and said, "I made a special request that you be in the same cell as Joey Valino. You remember him?" Joey Valino was a guy I busted my first year. I may or may not have accidentally shot the tip of his dick off. Ethan added, "I told him you were on your way. He said he would start stretching." If this was true, I could kiss my ass goodbye, literally. 10 minutes later, my lawyer showed up. He walked through the door and laid his briefcase on the table. I watched as Ethan's jaw slowly dropped and the gum he'd been chewing spewed onto his lap. Adam Gray looked at me and said, "Don't say another word." Chapter 38. Ethan and Erica left the room and Adam and I conferred. After 20 minutes, Adam waved the detectives back in. They walked through the door and sat. The cocky Ethan of earlier was nowhere to be seen. It was hard to believe that only weeks earlier, Ethan had led a handcuffed Adam Gray down the courthouse steps. And now here he was, an innocent man, representing quite possibly Ethan's least favorite person on the planet. Ah. Adam was dressed immaculately in a three-piece suit. Navy blue and probably cost what most people pay for a second-hand Kia. He lifted his right foot up onto the chair next to me and feigned tying his shoe. His shoe was tied, and I guessed it was more posturing than anything else. He stayed in that position, half-leaning, right foot up on the chair, and stared at the two detectives. Finally, he said, "After conferring with my client, it would appear there are a couple of small kinks in your investigation." Both Erica and Ethan sat upright. Adam took his foot off the chair and began pacing the small room. He said to no one in particular, "It would appear to me your case is based solely on the murder weapon. Is it safe to assume that if the murder weapon was not discovered in my client's sister's room, under the sister's bed, then my client wouldn't be here right now?" Ethan said, "We can also place your client at the scene. My client doesn't deny that he was with the victim. Actually, he did." "What do you mean?" Ethan's back straightened just slightly, and he said, "When we first questioned him about his whereabouts last night, he lied. He said he didn't leave the house, when in actuality, he was with the victim." Adam looked at me and said, "My client failed to inform me of this. Whoops." He turned his gaze to Erica, then back to Ethan. He then said, "Did it ever occur to you my client didn't want to discuss his New Year's Eve blowjob in front of your partner here?" Ethan looked at Erica, then back to Adam. He didn't have an answer. Erica gave a hesitant look in my direction, then broke away. Gray added, "And is it not true that when you did reveal the identity of the victim, my client volunteered freely that he was indeed with the victim on the night in question?" Ethan said nothing. Erica chimed in, "Yes. Thank you, Detective Frost." She gave him a thin nod. "But this isn't what concerns me. What concerns me is the murder weapon, the knife found under the sister's bed." Ethan said, "As it should. You found the murder weapon in the sister's room under the sister's bed. Is this correct?" "Where the weapon was found is moot. Your client consented to the search of the entire property." Adam said perfunctorily, "See, that's the problem." Ethan sat up. Erica leaned forward. I crossed my arms and smiled. Adam trained his eyes on Ethan and said, "By property, you are referring to the residence of 14 Magnolia Lane, Seattle, Washington, 98199. "That sounds right." "That residence belongs to my client's sister, a one Lacey Prescott." Ethan went limp. "My father had named me sole executor of his will. After all the red tape was cleared, debts paid, taxes remunerated, and stock options settled, what was left over was a healthy inheritance, not to mention two properties. My parents also owned a home in San Diego. My father was all but retired, having to sit in on a board of directors meeting every couple months, and my parents spent the majority of the winter in San Diego. The inheritance went into a joint bank account, accessible to both Lacey and me. The deed to the San Diego property was under my name, The deed to the Magnolia House was under Lacey Ann Prescott. Adams said, "Only the owner of a property can consent to a search of said property. This would make the knife inadmissible in court." Ethan blew out a long exhale, the weight of his blunder almost visible on his slouched shoulders. "The property deed will have to be verified." I said, "It will be on file at the King County Recorder's office." Ethan was down but not out. He said with a smirk, "Unfortunately, it's a holiday weekend. The recorder's office is closed until Monday." He turned to Adam and said, "Looks like your client will be spending a couple days in the county jail after all." I looked at Adam and shook my head. Adam called the judge. I knew enough about the law to know that if the judge who signed the arrest warrant saw fit, he could dismiss the order. Adam said, "I think that's a terrific idea." He turned to Ethan. "Who signed the arrest warrant?" "Judge Hardin." "Call him." "I would, but we barely caught him at his home. He and his wife are headed to the San Juans for the holiday weekend." He tried to give the impression there wasn't anything he could do. I said, "Call his cell." Ethan scoffed and said, "Hardin doesn't believe in cell phones. He says they make people easy to find." Adam laughed. I had a feeling he'd heard those exact words from the mouth of the lion himself. He looked at me and said, "Don't worry, Harriet should have hers with her." "Harriet?" "Yes, Harriet, his wife." Adam whipped out his cell phone and dialed. Ethan stared on with horror. After a long couple seconds, Adam said, "Harriet, how are you? Happy New Year to you two. So I hear you're headed to the San Juans. Lovely this time of year. Listen, can I have a quick word with Bob? I know, but it's important." "Will do." He looked at me and winked. Ethan was slowly turning a shade of green. Adam started back up. "Slow down, Bob. I'm doing you a favor here. Will you listen to me? About the arrest warrant you signed." "Yeah, well, it wasn't his property." "No, I'm not shitting you. You have to dismiss the charges." "Yeah, right here. You want to talk to him?" Adam handed the phone to Ethan, who took it as though it were made of enriched uranium. Meanwhile, Erica was trying to hide a widening grin. After taking what must have been a 2-minute tongue-lashing, Ethan handed the phone back to Adam. For a moment, I thought he was going to cry. My lawyer listened for another minute, then said, yeah, no problem." "Yes, that could have been embarrassing. Next Thursday, I'll make the tea time." 10 minutes later, I walked out of the Seattle Police Department, a free man. Chapter 39. I spent the better part of the holiday weekend feeling sorry for myself. Now, I'm not saying if you're a woman and you let me into your life, you are destined to meet an untimely death, but my record was pretty grisly. Just over a year before, the last case I worked, my ex-fiancée was brutally murdered, and both my sister and Alex came very close to being killed. That's why I had run from that life. That's why I was back in Seattle, to escape it all. Mind my own business and maybe, just maybe, stop getting people killed. But there are some things you can't run from. Just ask Riley Peterson. But now I was involved. I no longer had control over my actions. I was like that big boulder in Indiana Jones in the Temple of Doom. Riley's death had set me in motion, and I wouldn't stop. Couldn't stop until I crushed whoever had killed her. I was about to snap. I needed to go running. I laced up the old Asics and started into the drizzle. After about a half mile, the crime scene photos of Riley flashed through my mind. I tried to blink the images away, but they didn't waver. I knew from past experience that these images would play over and over until I found out who killed her, who robbed her of her life. If Riley had just been murdered, I might have been able to write this off as a terrible coincidence, just another victim of the ubiquitous black cloud that had shrouded my life for the past decade. But I'd been framed for her murder. Someone either wanted me locked up or they wanted to send a clear message that I was snooping around in something I shouldn't be. Was this the same person that framed Adam Gray for his wife's murder? I didn't see how it could be anyone else. Ellen and Riley's murders had to be connected. Speaking of Ellen, the more I thought about her, the more I was convinced whoever killed her wanted her body to be discovered. I thought about where Gray's yacht had been driven that night and how her body had been dumped. This particular channel of the Sound was probably the most highly trafficked waterway in all of the Pacific Northwest. You had multiple ferries crisscrossing through the water every 30 minutes. You had boats coming in and out of Fisherman's Terminal at all hours. Not to mention a Coast Guard station, one of the five largest shipping piers on the West Coast, and four tourist overlooks. There were more eyes scanning this particular area than possibly any other waterway in the United States. I mean, the chances of Ellen's body not being found were astronomical. But why? Why would someone want her body found? Obviously, they wanted to frame Adam for her murder, but this seemed almost after the fact. Maybe I was looking at this all wrong. Maybe I needed to start looking at this from a new perspective. Not Ellen, but Adam. Maybe one of Adam's clients. I'm sure he represented his fair share of shady individuals, but from what I'd read, he'd gotten most of them off scot-free, so they should be sending him fruit baskets, not framing him for his wife's murder. Then he had Riley. What was her role? She was peripherally connected to Ellen through the North Cascades. Had Riley seen or heard something and kept quiet? She didn't seem the type. Maybe she knew something without knowing it, and maybe whoever killed her thought I would be the one to drag it out of her. Or maybe they killed her just to piss me off. Which brought us back to me. Once again, I'd found myself tangled up in a sticky web of death. Was I an innocent fly that had been caught unexpectedly by the trap? Not really. But Riley had been. Ellen possibly as well. Even Adam hadn't intentionally been prodding and poking at the web as I had. I'd been the one to awaken the spider. I'd been the one flying around watching as the spider silently crept up to his captive and sank in his teeth. But who was the spider? I didn't have the faintest idea. My gut had always told me it had something to do with the North Cascades. This was the only point where Riley, Ellen, and I connected. I had a feeling Ellen Gray's relationship with the North Cascades went a bit deeper than hiking and leisure. I had a couple more questions. I wanted to throw at Kim, Ellen's press secretary. But my mind was sapped. I needed to set it all aside for a while. I needed to see Harold. As per regulations, I stopped at the front desk to sign in before I made my way to Harold's room. The woman at the desk was new, maybe a couple hours younger than the dug-up corpse I was used to seeing, and she picked up the clipboard after I signed it. I'm guessing the other lady had made the move from employee to resident. Anyhow, the lady raised her penciled in eyebrows and said, "Who's C.H.?" "Cretaceous Harold." Her eyebrows nearly touched or overlapped, and I said, "That's what he told me to call him." She checked a ledger, and her face fell. Uh-oh. She said, "I have some bad news." I took a deep breath. I wasn't stable enough to handle the old coot kicking the bucket. I mean, I know, sometimes old people die. But Harold was really, really, really old. He was nearly mummified. It had never registered that he was, in fact, pushing his luck. I asked, "Dead?" She shook her head. "Not yet." "Yet?" She added, "He's in the hospital wing. Took a pretty bad fall a couple days ago, broke both his wrists." I tried to hold in a laugh, but was unsuccessful. The image of Harold with a cast on each wrist was too much. But the good news was I wouldn't have to hear any more polka anytime soon. I asked, "Can I see him?" She said I could and gave me directions. I made my way to the hospital wing, which should have been called the morgue wing. In the hallway, I passed two black bags, or as we referred to them in my past life, two deadies. I found his room and peeked through the small window in the closed door. I could see Harold sitting upright in the bed, his casted arms crossed over his chest. He had an IV in one arm and an oxygen mask over his mouth. A nurse was standing in front of a large machine with a clipboard. My stomach tightened. I think there was more to the story than just two broken wrists. I pushed through the door. The nurse, an attractive black woman, glanced at me and smiled. I smiled back and said, "How is he?" She leaned her head to the side and said, "He's stable." "What happened?" "Well, they initially brought him here for two broken wrists. Poor guy thought he had his walker in front of him and leaned forward to take a step. Fell face first. Snapped both wrists." I glanced at Harold. The oxygen mask over his mouth filled with fog as his chest fell. His glasses were off and sitting on a small tray, just to his left. I asked, "What's with all the tubes?" She put the clipboard down, uncrossed Harold's arms, and set them at his sides. She looked up and said, "While they were setting his wrists, he had what's called an emphysema attack. Basically, it's just a violent coughing attack, but it can easily cause a heart attack or stroke or internal bleeding. Luckily, he was in the hospital wing, and we could give him something to quell it right off." I nodded. On a small side table were 6 or 7 cards, a couple bouquets of flowers, a coffee mug, 2 AA batteries, a blue Sharpie, a stapler, and a snack pack of tapioca pudding. The nurse noticed my gaze and said, "They steal things, then send them to each other as get-well presents." I laughed. Maybe I could get a job here as a security guard. Patrol the halls. Catch one of these guys stealing the batteries out of a remote and send him to a week in the hole. The nurse started for the door and said, "The meds we gave him should wear off here pretty soon, so he might wake up." She waved the clipboard at me and walked out. I read a couple of the cards while I ate the pudding. Then I made my way to the window at the back of the room and peered out. There was a clear view of the lake. The shallow parts near the shore were frozen, but the water in the deep center still carried a soft ripple. I heard a cough and turned. Harold was awake. I could see him fidgeting with the mask with his 2 white club hands. I walked over to him and lifted the mask off his face. His usual oxygen tank was sitting beside the bed, and I helped him get it situated. Then I took his glasses off the side table and slid them over his large nose. His eyes widened when he saw me. I said, "I'm the new nurse."
"Where's Oprah?"
"Oprah?"
"Yeah, the black lady."
I laughed. "She said she'd be back in a bit." His eyes lit up. I think he liked her. I imagined through those thick lenses she did look a lot like Oprah. I said, "You want to play Frisbee?" The joke was lost on him. We chatted about his injury for a couple minutes. I told him he was made of balsa. He thought this was funny and had a small cough attack. I made a mental note to take my hilarious antics, quips, and witticisms down a couple notches. I mean, if I so much as farted, Harold could be a goner. Plus Ethan would probably arrest me for homicide. I don't know if Harold sensed his time was running out, but he didn't waste much of it. He leaned his head back, staring at the ceiling, and said,
"After seeing Elizabeth, I was a mess."
Harold couldn't think. He kept putting things on backwards. He could barely hold a screwdriver. He was constantly sweating. His muscles ached. His stomach was in knots. He couldn't eat. He lost 10 pounds. Finally, he was forced to quit his job. His boss was loyal to a fault and told him it was a shame to lose him, and there would always be a job for him if he wanted to come back. Harold appreciated his boss's kindness, but he wasn't sure if he could ever work another day of his life. He was having trouble breathing enough times to get through each day. It was worse. It was worse than 3 years earlier. How was that possible? Wasn't time supposed to heal all wounds? How could he feel this way after 3 years? How could he feel this way about a girl he'd never had a conversation with in person? The first time Harold went by the school, he just did one quick pass. There was a high wrought iron fence surrounding the small campus, with a gate in the front for cars and people to come and go. 3 large buildings stood on the well-manicured grounds, 3 stories of dark brick each. He saw a single girl walking on campus on his first pass. She was dressed in a black skirt and white blouse. It wasn't Elizabeth. Harold made a second pass a half hour later. He didn't know much about the goings-on of a college campus, but he assumed the girls got a break between classes. The courtyard filled up with the young women, all dressed the same. Black skirt, white blouse. He saw 30 girls that could have been Elizabeth. It was impossible to tell. Harold did the same the next day and then the next. He took to wearing different clothes, a hat one day, carrying an umbrella the next. He would walk slowly and scan the masses, the group of girls sitting in a circle giggling, the lone girl sitting against a tree reading, the 3 girls eating lunch at the picnic table. This went on for days, then weeks. Harold would go at different times, sometimes early, sometimes late. Sometimes he would get a newspaper and sit on the bus bench across the street. He never saw her, although he wasn't exactly sure what he would do if he did see her. Just run up to the fence and scream how much he loved her, how he couldn't eat, couldn't sleep, couldn't live without her. Harold noticed the men on a Wednesday. There were a handful of them, maybe 6 or 7. The men were roughly the same age as he was. A couple looked to be even a tad younger. 3 of them were mowing the lawn of the large grounds. Others were trimming hedges. 2 were planting flowers. Another was on a ladder washing the windows. Every once in a while, a group of the girls would approach one of the men. They would talk to him and blush and giggle. Then one of the teachers would walk over and chastise the girls, and they would continue giggling as they walked away. Harold shook his head. It never changed. These girls were the elite. They weren't allowed to talk to the groundskeepers. It's just the way it was. Maybe that's how it would always be. Harold watched this dynamic of the grounds crew, the young women, and the teachers for 3 Wednesdays. On the 4th Wednesday, Harold got up early. He put on a ratty pair of jeans and a white T-shirt. He hadn't shaved in a couple days, and he had a bit of stubble. He looked in the mirror and smiled. Harold wasn't sure how early they arrived. He guessed they got there pretty early to beat the heat, so he got in position at 5:30. The men arrived promptly at 6, each carrying a box. Harold wasn't sure what was in the boxes. They came to the gate, and it was unlocked by a well-dressed fat man. His hair was slicked back, and he greeted them with a sneer. He looked familiar, like one of Harold's commanders from his days in the army. He stuck a key in the large gate lock. Harold made his move. He crossed the street and bellied up to the back of the group. One by one, they walked past the man at the gate. When Harold passed, the man put his arm out. He said, "Never seen you before, boy." Harold managed, "I'm new." They decided to add a man so he could get out of here quicker. The large man contemplated this, then let Harold through. He locked up the gate, and Harold followed the men to a shed. One of the guys, a kid around Harold's age, with a shaved head and a thin mustache, turned and said, "Don't mind him, that's the dean of the school. He's an asshole." The guy stuck out his hand. "I'm Jimmy." Harold stuck with Jimmy, who was in charge of washing windows. There were 117 in all. Jimmy liked to talk. In 2 hours in and 28 windows later, according to Jimmy's count, Harold had almost forgotten why he was there in the first place. At 9, the room started to fill up. Jimmy said, "Just ignore him." A couple of girls made small waves at them, or winked. Harold blushed a couple times. He thought if he saw Elizabeth, he would most certainly fall off his ladder. At 11, the grounds filled up with the young women. Harold peered around every so often, but for the most part, he concentrated on the job at hand. He was having trouble keeping up with the speedy Jimmy. A half hour later, the rooms filled back up, and Jimmy said it was time for a break. The 7 men, plus Harold, found a spot in the shade, and each opened up the box they'd been carrying. Lunch. Harold couldn't believe he forgot to pack a lunch. For the first time in a long time, he was starving. One of the other guys, Harold was pretty sure his name was Robbie, asked, "Why ain't you eating?" Harold grinned sheepishly. "Forgot my lunch on the kitchen table, and on my first day, of all things." The guys took a laugh at this. Jimmy ripped a large chunk of sandwich off and handed it to him. Each of the other 6 men did the same. Harold felt an instant camaraderie he hadn't felt since the army. The 8 of them ate and talked shop for an hour. Harold mostly listened. Someone brought up the war, and Harold chimed in. When the guys found out Harold had been in the war, D-Day even, they peppered him with questions. By the end of the day, he was just one of the guys. They broke for the day, and Harold asked Jimmy, "Where are you guys going tomorrow?" They were doing another college on the other side of town. Harold was there, with a lunchbox. They did another college on Friday. Harold was there. Harold walked by the school twice over the weekend. Girls came and went, but Harold didn't see Elizabeth. They did a large private estate on Monday and Tuesday. Harold was there. The next Wednesday came fast. Harold quickly became friends with all 7 guys. Jimmy, Robbie, Marky, Jake, Ben, Jerry, and Perry. Harold saw a couple girls he thought might have been Elizabeth. There was one girl he was sure was her, but after tapping the glass, he turned and it wasn't. On Friday, Jimmy handed Harold an envelope. When Harold opened it and found it filled with cash, he looked surprised. Jimmy said, "I thought something was fishy about you." Harold was silent. Jimmy shrugged. "I don't much care. I told the boss I hired another guy to help with the windows. Said he preferred to be paid in cash if that was all right." Boss shrugged and said he didn't much care as long as the job gets done. Harold and the guys hit a bar after work on Friday. Harold didn't remember ever having so much fun. Summer came and the school cleared out, so he didn't have to worry about seeing Elizabeth. In August, the girls came back. It happened the first week of September. It was about a half hour before the girls would break and Jimmy and Harold were working on the south building. They usually did the north building second, but the sun had moved over the months and they kept the shade the longest that they got the south building out of the way early. Harold had, for the most part, stopped his incessant scanning of the classrooms, but every once in a while he would sneak a peek. He'd never seen the group he saw that day as he peered into the small classroom. On the blackboard, behind the teacher, he could see some scribbles that he thought looked like poetry. Every once in a while, a girl would come to the front and read from a notebook. Harold watched as one girl sat down and another stood up. She walked to the front and turned. It was Elizabeth.
Harold couldn't breathe.
He watched as she read from her notebook.
Jimmy said, "What's wrong? Come on, we're lagging behind here, Harry."
He ignored Jimmy and watched Elizabeth. Her chest heaved as she read, and he could see tears running down her cheeks. She was crying. Elizabeth walked back to her seat, head down, never looking in his direction. Later at lunch, Harold ate his ham and cheese in silence as the others told stories. Robbie asked, "Why are you so quiet over there, Harry?" Harold looked around and then he told them. He told them the whole story. An hour break turned into a two-hour break. No one spoke. They hung on his every word. When he was done, Marky asked, "What are you going to do?" Harold sighed and said, "What can I do?" Jimmy smiled and said, "I have an idea." And so the eight of them hatched a plan.
"Hatched a plan?" I shook my head. "What are you, a bunch of bank robbers?"
Harold laughed, and then he coughed. And then he coughed some more. By the time I returned with the nurse, Harold was coughing so violently I thought he was going to break in half. The nurse injected a syringe into his IV, removed Harold's glasses, and put the mask over his face. His coughing slowed. A minute later, Harold's breathing had stabilized. I took a deep breath. The nurse, Oprah, came over to me and said, "You okay?" I nodded. She patted me on the arm and said, "Don't worry, he'll be all right." After she left, I watched Harold for a good 10 minutes. Then I grabbed the Sharpie off the counter and signed Harry's cast. Chapter 40. The Seattle freeway system, for the most part, is a never-ending logjam. However, today, the first Monday of the new year, it teetered on undrivable. I looked at the dash. 9:27 a.m. I'd started merging onto the on-ramp at 9:03. I was maybe a third of the way up, and I hadn't moved in 5 minutes. Things started to loosen up an hour later, and I made it to Capitol Hill right around 11. These government types were creatures of habit, at least the ones I'd come across, so I took up a seat in the small cafe. At exactly 11:20 a.m., Kim made his way into the cafe and took up a spot in the sandwich bar line. Today, he was decked out in lime. Lime dress shirt and lime tie. He looked like a popsicle. A very gay popsicle. He paid for his sandwich and coffee and made for a table in the rear. He didn't notice me or pretended not to, and I made my way over to his table. He was just about to take a bite of his wrap when he looked up at me. I patted him on the shoulder and said, "You mind?" He choked down the bite and said, "Sure, but I'm meeting with Bill Eggers in about 10 minutes. I sat. "So did Ellen go hiking often?" "Not really. She'd just recently gotten into it. She'd driven to the North Cascades sometime in early September. Then she'd gone pretty much every weekend after that."
"Hmm. And she just liked the outdoors, I guess."
He paused and I said,
"What?"
"Well, sometimes I'd talk to her after she was done hiking, and she'd always seem depressed, like she just spent 10 hours at a press conference."
"Odd." A thought struck me.
"The backpack that they found? What about it?"
"Wasn't there a camera?
It was one of the disposable jobbies.
Were there any pictures on it?"
"Only had 2 shots on it. One was of a fox. The other was of a footprint."
"A footprint?"
"Well, an animal track."
"What kind of animal?"
He paused, then said, "It was a wolf track." Back to the wolves. What was Ellen's infatuation with wolves?
He looked around the small coffee shop, then said, "She detested them."
"Detested them? Then why was she lobbying for people to vote yes on ballot measure 217?
"She wasn't."
I was confused. I saw a photograph of her standing in front of a group of people, and they all had signs that read "Vote Yes on 217. Those are protesters.
It took a moment for the shoe to fall.
So Ellen was against measure 217.
Fervently against.
He paused, then said, "Measure 217 was a repeal of SC 1670.
"What's SC 1670?
Is that the new Lexus?"
"SC 1670 was Ellen's first bill put into law."
He messed around with his BlackBerry, tapped a couple buttons, then turned it to me. "Senate Bill Report, SC 1670. As reported by Senate Committee on U.S. Fish and Wildlife Committee, April 3, 2007. Title, An Act Relating to Gray Wolf Management. Brief description, prohibiting the introduction of the gray wolf into the state of Washington. Sponsors, Governor Ellen Gray. Committee activity, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, 225-06-3306. Senate Committee on U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Majority Report, do pass. Signed by Senators Oki, Chair, Sheenan, Vice Chair, Dumit, Esser, Morton, and Stecker, Staff, Victor Mooney, 786-7469. I looked up. Okay, so she hated wolves. Why? He took a deep breath and said, wolves have always been a sensitive topic, by and large the most sensitive of any animal in North America. I've heard that. When they reintroduced wolves to Yellowstone National Park a couple years back, it started all sorts of conflict. There's a saying, I quipped, wolves can get along with people, but people can't always get along with wolves. Right. But with all the other things going on, how did Ellen Gray make time to protest wolves returning to Washington? He licked his lips and said, what I'm about to tell you only a handful of people know. Ellen once told me she never even told her husband. I nodded. Ellen rarely talked about her childhood. She left home when she was 16. She kept in contact with one brother, but for the most part, she erased her family from her past. She grew up on a ranch. Her parents raised livestock, which back then, in the 60s, wasn't a bad way to make a living. Wisconsin, right? Right. Anyhow, she had three older brothers and one younger brother. The younger brother adored her, went everywhere she went. One day, Ellen is home alone with them. They aren't allowed to leave the house because in the last weeks they'd lost over a third of their cattle to a wolf pack. Happened a lot back then. I saw where this was going. Ellen didn't go into the details, but she was playing with her brother and he went outside. They were running around and next thing she knew, three wolves pounced on him and ripped him to shreds. I leaned back. Her family blamed her. She blamed herself. She never wanted it to get out because no one would take her bill seriously if they found out. He paused, then said, Ellen Gray has single-handedly kept wolves out of Washington for the last 4 years. Until now. He nodded. Until now. Chapter 41. Kim and I chatted for another 10 minutes, then I borrowed his BlackBerry and put in a call to Hans. After a couple of minutes, the portly medical examiner came on the line. Hello? Hans, it's Thomas.
Thomas, so nice to hear your voice.
I could hear him chewing and said, what are you eating?
How'd you know?
Easy, you're always eating. He laughed.
This is true. Egg salad sandwich.
My stomach rumbled. I said, listen, I need a favor.
Sure thing.
I told him what I was after. I walked to the enormous library across the street and found an empty computer. I Googled Ellen Gray and clicked on the webpage I'd browsed a couple weeks prior. I scrolled down the page until I came to her priorities and clicked on Caring for Washington Ranchers and Farmers. The first couple paragraphs concerned the Washington Ranchers Society and their annual fundraiser. Then there were links to legislation that affected ranchers and farmers. Of the three ballot measures listed, I clicked on Ballot Measure 217. A small write-up confirmed what Kim had said. Ballot Measure 217 was a repeal of Bill SE-1670, which, if passed, would allow the introduction of the gray wolf to Washington. A hyperlink was marked Wolf Speech, and I clicked on it. A media window popped up and a clip buffered, then began playing. Governor Ellen Gray was behind a podium. A giant sign behind her read Vote No on 217. The camera panned to the audience. I hit pause. The frame went still. The majority of these people were holding signs that read Vote Yes on 217 or Let the Wolf Return. One sign read, Stop playing God with our wolves. Quite a few of the people were wearing shirts that read, Defenders of Wildlife. It was almost identical to the picture I'd seen the first time I'd researched the governor at the library. I'd thought these people were there to support the governor, but in actuality, they were there to protest. I hit play. Ellen said, We are here today to call attention to the economic impact wolves would have on our great state. There was some heavy booing. One person yelled, Give us back our wolves! I heard a couple jeers, and I could also see that there were a few supporters intermixed with the protesters. After some light introductory remarks, the governor said, In 1995, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service began wolf recovery efforts in Idaho with release of 15 wolves. The Idaho wolf population has steadily increased to an estimated 661 in 2007. I could hear some soft cheering in the background. In 1996, after the first fiscal year of the wolves' reintroduction, Wildlife Service expenditures were an estimated $16,000 in state funds for addressing wolf-related issues, conducting predation investigations and wolf control actions. In 2001, these expenditures had risen to over $150,000, almost a 1,000% increase. In 2007, these trends continued, and wolf expenditures had risen to nearly $1.5 million. If these trends continue, by 2020, these expenditures will rise to over $100 million. For the most part, everyone was quiet. She took a breath and said, "Nearly 30% of all farms and ranches in Washington are within a 50-mile radius of the North Cascades and Olympia National Parks. With the close proximity of these ranches, costs in Washington would far exceed those of Idaho, threatening the very livelihood of many ranchers. Even if annual losses are as low as 10%, this 10% may seem insignificant, but in this time of very tight agricultural margins, that amount of added costs is critical." A thundering applause arose from the supporters. The governor waited for quiet, then said, "I'd like to introduce Barry Stedmore. He owns a ranch in Montana." A man in jeans and a plaid shirt stepped to the podium. He had black hair swept across his forehead, almost like this was the first time he'd styled his hair. He said, "I own a ranch, or I guess I should say I used to own a ranch near Bozeman, Montana." He spoke for a couple minutes, talking about how Bozeman-area ranch families have taken heavy hits to their bottom line due to wolves killing and maiming their cattle. Over the course of 3 years, wolves killed nearly 15% of his annual cattle production, and just recently, not 6 months earlier, his land was seized by the government. He ended with, "Ranchers are losing their calves. Wolves are killing them. The ranching economy bears an unfair portion of the costs. If America wants wolves back, why are we paying for it?" Again, heavy applause erupted from Governor Gray's supporters. The man stepped off the stage and the governor returned. The camera panned to the audience, and I noticed that a good portion of the protesters had lowered their signs. You could see it on their faces. Seeing the actual effects on this simple man had impacted them. The governor stepped to the microphone and said, "My sole purpose today is to remind everyone that, while we all have an opinion on wolves, ranchers are the ones that are dealing directly with the impact of their presence. I just want everybody to understand that there is a cost involved with the reintroduction of wolves, and I urge you to vote no on Measure 217 come November." The clip ended. I noticed the date in the bottom right corner, 10/25/2009. Ellen had given this speech the last week of October last year, and the repeal failed to pass. I had a feeling she would have given the same speech this year had she not been killed, but she had been, and the repeal had passed, and wolves had returned to Washington State. The deli was called The Pickle. It was 6 blocks down the street from the Seattle Police Department headquarters. I spotted Hans sitting in the back booth. He looked to be about 2/3 of the way through his sandwich. I slid in the opposite side of the booth and asked, "Didn't you just eat?" His mouth was full, but he puffed his cheeks into a sort of smile. "Did you do what I asked?" he garbled. I did. And he wiped a large drop of mustard from the side of his mouth and said, "The results are quite astounding." "Cut the accent crap, Hans." He nodded and said in perfect English, "Sorry, the results are quite astounding." He could control his accent when he wanted to. "I mean, the guy grew up in Detroit." He continued, "I cross-referenced the teeth marks in Ellen Gray with a number of different submarine animals." I hadn't told him much, just that I wanted him to run the bite marks from Ellen Gray's body through his mainframe and come up with a match. He started back in. "I'd actually taken an impression of 2 of the bites during the autopsy. I hadn't looked into it much deeper than that, just assumed it was a killer whale or a barracuda or something. I figured when you have a hole in your forehead, it doesn't much matter what's been nibbling on you, right? Anyhow, the curvature of the teeth didn't match any fish in the system. These teeth were big and differently sized. Most fish have small teeth, roughly the same width and diameter throughout, save for sharks. I thought perhaps it might have been a smaller species of shark, simply because in many places the tissue was ripped from the body as opposed to bitten." "Go on." "So I scanned the impression plate I'd made, loaded it into the computer databases, and ran it against our known animal index." I said, "I bet I know what came up. Do you now?" "Canis lupus." He laughed and said, "Right. Ellen Gray had been attacked by a wolf. I asked Hans to keep a lid on this for a couple days. He said he would, and I thanked him and left. I thought it was time I had a chat with the professor. Chapter 42. As I drove to the North Cascades, a rather fuzzy picture started to come into focus. I couldn't believe it had taken me so long to piece it all together. It's funny. You make all these small notations. The river empties right into the sound. She was hiking in the North Cascades. You record these small snippets of conversation. She detested wolves. He had a doggy. You make all these little chalk marks. Right, she'd been attacked by a wolf. I don't know what he'd do if the repeal hadn't passed. They mean utterly nothing all by themselves, but when grouped together, they tell a story. Or in this case, a murder. I looked at the picture sitting on the seat beside me. At the library, I'd done a quick Google of the professor. He wasn't hard to find. These nutjobs never are. His name was Theodore Coble. Grew up on a houseboat out in the Sound in the early 70s. Received his doctorate in animal behavior from Seattle Pacific University and went on to teach the very subject at the very university. In 1993, he'd taken a research trip to Canada to study wolves. Apparently, he had fallen in love with them. Even, get this, after he was attacked by one of the wolves and his trachea and larynx were ripped from his neck. Barely survived. But after surgery, he spent the next 14 years living with the wolves. I picked up the picture I'd printed of him and stared at it. It was a close-up of him standing in front of a chalkboard. According to the article, the birth defect Coble suffered from was called a congenital hemangioma. Taking up the better part of the left side of the professor's face was a reddish-purple birthmark. It looked like an ink stain running down the length of his nose, blanketing his left eye, the edge of his mouth, his entire cheek, and running down into his collar. At some point on the drive, I checked my rearview mirror and noticed a black sedan keeping pace a quarter mile behind me. I wondered how long they'd been following me. In all probability, they had been with me since I left my house this morning, so they knew I went to the Capitol building. Did they know I met with Kim? I had to assume they did. I thought about turning around, but if I hadn't been arrested yet, I wasn't sure I'd be arrested at all. Or maybe Ethan wanted me to get as deep into the shit as possible before he made his move. He'd already arrested me once, and that hadn't worked out in his favor. The only thing that worried me was that Ethan would put together the connection between Ellen Gray, Riley Peterson, the North Cascades, the professor, and wolves. I didn't want him to get credit for the bust. Old habits die hard. But I had a hard time believing he would put two and two together. I mean, the guy could barely figure out how to work a Powerade bottle. Plus, I could always tell him I was paying my respects to Riley. No one could question this. I went over a small hill and pulled to the shoulder. 30 seconds later, the black sedan flew by. I waited. One Mississippi. Two Mississippi. Three Mississippi. The brake lights flashed and the car pulled to the side. I laughed, threw the car in drive, and flipped off the two goons as I passed. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Building once again appeared vacant. As I was parking in the dirt lot, a Jeep pulled in and parked not far from me. An extremely large black man stepped out. He was wearing the same tan outfit Riley had been when we met, as well as a brimmed hat. He had a remarkable likeness to Smokey the Bear. I suspected this would be Herb. I stepped from the car and approached him. He had a toothpick dangling from the left corner of his mouth. He was one of the few black men I'd ever seen with freckles. He muttered, "What can I do for you, Chief?" He had a thick accent. Cajun meets Scottish. William Wallace meets Mardi Gras. I really wanted him to say, "Only you can prevent forest fires," just to see what it sounded like. I didn't particularly want him to know who I was, but I did pass on my condolences as to his partner's passing. He didn't ask how I knew her or who I was. He just started talking about Riley, how great she was, always smiling, always acting mad when he ate her food, but he knew she packed it just for him. I didn't have the heart to tell him that she didn't pack those lunches for him. He still seemed pretty broken up about her death. This would make two of us. Finally, he said, "If you'd excuse me, I got some paper to push. Just me to do it all now." I asked, "Do you mind if I take one of the sleds for a spin?" "Those are government property." "Yeah, that's what Riley said." He raised his eyebrows. "Riley take you out on one of the sleds?" "Sure did." He shrugged. Dad, if she trusts you, I trust you. Keys are in the ignition. I told him the sled was in good hands. He nodded, but I don't think he cared if I drove the sled into the river. After we shook hands, he headed into the building, and I made my way over to the snowmobiles. I plopped down on one of the two-seaters, and I hit the red starter button. The route to the den was easy enough, and the tall fence came into view after 10 minutes. I crept to the edge of the tree line and cut the engine. The wolves were out in the open about 2 football fields from the small field house. A handful of the wolves weren't doing much, standing stoic, gazing across the whiteness. But about half were playing, wrestling around. It took me a moment to register that one of the wrestlers was a man. He was dressed in the same white snowsuit, same white beanie pulled down over his face. Professor Theodore Coble. I watched for a good 5 minutes as this idiot rolled around with these wolves. From this far away, you would have thought it was a man playing with his dogs. I waited for one of the wolves to go Siegfried and Roy on him, but it never happened. It would appear he was one of them, or the pack had accepted him as such. I drove the snowmobile up near the fence. The wolves stopped playing and stared in my direction. The professor was on his hands and knees doing precisely the same. I had little doubt this man, or wolf, werewolf, or whatever this guy thought he was, killed both Ellen Gray and Riley Peterson. I waved him over. He reluctantly stood, strapped on his cross-country skis, and made his way over. Even if he thought he was a wolf, he was still in charge of this project and had to play the part of human every once in a while, at least for another week, until they released the wolves. Then I had a feeling no one would ever see this whack job again. He skied up to the fence and stopped. The wolves never took their eyes off him, not for a second. Only the professor's eyes and mouth could be seen, the red plague visible over his left eye and a bit of his mouth. His left eye, a white oasis in a sea of red, carried a pink cast. It was impossible not to feel a bit of sympathy for the guy, but my sympathy glands were a bit fatigued and I couldn't muster much. I said, "Are you Professor Coble?" He nodded. "Can I ask you a couple questions?" He nodded. "Can you speak?" He shook his head and made a coughing sound. I took the combination as a no. I hopped off the snowmobile and trudged to the fence. We were only inches from one another. "Okay, then you stand there and you listen. I know you killed Ellen Gray and I know you murdered Riley Peterson. And I don't give a shit what's growing on your face so that you think you're a fucking wolf." He didn't move. "I know how it all played out. You've been pushing to have these wolves reintroduced for the past 3 years, and each year you fell short. Why? Because Governor Ellen Gray strongly opposed wolves. Did you know why? Because one of your buddies over there ate her little fucking brother. Yeah, slaughtered him right in front of her. That's why your repeal never passed. And you knew with Ellen in the picture the bill would never be overturned. Never had a chance. But you tried to convince people that wolves were harmless. You even took one with you when you went to Pike Place Market." He made no reaction. I felt my voice rise. "You know what I think? I think you've secretly been bringing wolves here for years now. That's why the governor would come here every Sunday. She was spotting for any sign of wolves. She just knew. So when you saw her, you knew what you had to do. You put a bullet in her forehead. Then you let your friends munch on her. Then you threw her body in the river. This starting to sound familiar to you?" I thought I saw the tug of a smile on his lips, or maybe it was a snarl. If there hadn't been a fence between us, I would have knocked his birth defect off his face. I took a breath and said, "With the governor out of the way, there was no one to protest the repeal, no one to call attention to the ramifications of wolves on the local ranchers and surrounding communities. And what do you know? The repeal passed. After you got the go-ahead, it dawned on you that somehow, some way, this would be traced back to you. And if it was, it would be so long wolves. So you decided to frame her husband for the murder. You grabbed the tranquilizer gun, follow Adam from his office, shoot him, rough him up, steal his keys, take his yacht out. You're familiar with boats. You grew up on a boat. And you knew if Ellen's body ever did surface, it would have been carried out by the raging river and would surface somewhere in the Sound." I leaned into the fence, the cold steel pressing deep into my cheek. "But you didn't count on me. And when you saw me that day, you knew that I was closing in on you and that I was going to put a stop to you and your little wolf factory. So you decide Riley has to go, and you figure you'll frame me for her murder. Ellen's dead, Riley's dead, and I'm going away for 2 lifetimes. Is that right? Is that how you planned it out?" He didn't move. "Well, it didn't work, because here I am, And you're the one who's going to be locked in a cage for 2 lifetimes, buddy. That's right, shitbag, locked up. A caged animal. He remained impassive. I wondered what he was thinking. Was he thinking about living in an 8-foot by 6-foot cell the rest of his life? Could he survive? I looked at this frail man who'd had, if not a horrible life, a hard one, and decided he wouldn't last an hour. My options were limited. I could hop the fence, but he was on skis, and I wouldn't stand a chance. If I had the forethought to bring a gun, I would be at the advantage, but I didn't see the guy just putting his hands behind his back and surrendering. He was, at least in his deranged brain, a wild animal, so there's no telling what he would do. I could see him tame 1 second, then latch onto my neck the next. But in order to pull off Ellen Gray and Riley Peterson's murders, not to mention Adams and my framing, they also needed to be cold and calculating. It dawned on me that I was glad there was a fence between the two of us. Professor Coble was a different scary than I'd ever come across. A deep hollow echo broke me from my reverie, and both the professor and I turned. The wolves, all 11 of them, were back on their haunches, howling at the spirits above. Or maybe they were calling to their buddies who roamed freely. I looked back at the professor. He was gone, skiing back to the pack. As the professor neared, the howling subsided. The pack jumped up and started for the trees, the professor just a step behind on his skis. It took a moment for it all to register, for the gravity of what I'd just witnessed to sink into the bloodstream, to be sucked into each and every cell in my body. Riley had also said the wolves howl to call the pack together. The wolves had been calling to the professor. Chapter 43. I hadn't eaten anything all day, and I was starving. And to be brutally honest, I needed a drink. In fact, I needed a couple drinks. I pulled my car into the dirt lot and stepped out. The taxpayers' hard-earned money followed me into the lot and parked. I saluted my buddies and made my way down the steep hill. The Flounder was still awash with Christmas lights, and its bright neon sign lit up the narrow walkway. High tide would be in the next half hour or so, and the cold, black water whished 5 feet below. A dozen boats of different makes and sizes were tied up to the pier, and my car was one of about 10 in the small lot. 11 if you counted Ace and Gary. There was a healthy crowd, and it was loud for 6 o'clock on a Wednesday night. I found a table and looked for Josie, but she wasn't running around in her skimpy little outfit. Darn. I flagged on a waitress and told her I had a medical condition, and if I didn't get a beer and a shot of tequila in the next minute, I would start frothing at the mouth. She laughed, and I started counting. 2 minutes later, I had a shot of Don Julio and half a beer rumbling around in my empty stomach. I ordered 3 burgers with fries and another beer. The waitress gave me a quizzical glance, and I told her I was training for one of those dog-eating contests. She said, "Don't you mean hot dogs?" "No, I mean terriers." She left in a rush to get my beer or call animal control. It was a crapshoot. Anyhow, I sipped on the beer and watched the local news, which was mostly weather and football. The Seahawks were playing the Arizona Cardinals in the NFC Championship. The Seahawks had home field advantage, and the game would be played in Quest Stadium come this Sunday. I stared through my half-empty glass and thought about superfan Riley Peterson for a long minute. When I looked up, they were doing the weather. Some huge storm was funneling down from Alaska. The storm had already punished parts of Canada with up to 3 feet of snow, and it looked to be getting stronger as it moved across the Pacific Northwest. According to the annoying man on the television waving his hands at the map, the snow would start sometime on Friday and continue through the weekend. They were calling for parts of the city to get over 20 inches, and parts of the high country to get anywhere from 3 to 5 feet. So much for old man Winter getting lost in Canada. I guess someone bought him one of those tracking bracelets. My food came, and I grabbed 2 of the baskets and made my way outside. Ace rolled down the window as I approached, and I handed the food through. They both thanked me, and Gary asked me for some ketchup. I told him to go jump off the Seattle Bridge. The burger soaked up the beer and the tequila, so I ordered another beer and another tequila. I was having a rather difficult time trying not to think about the case. Point in fact, I was now thinking about it in terms of the case. I wasn't sure how I wanted to play this with the professor. It could get tricky. If I killed him, and don't think I hadn't discounted the possibility, I would probably end up in jail. I could always go to the police. But for one, I didn't think anyone would believe me, and two, They would ask why I was sticking my nose into things I should not be sticking my nose into. Such things as tampering with an official investigation and countless other trivial charges in the general vicinity of jaywalking could be used against me. And I couldn't forget that I still had a murder charge hanging over my head. Of course, I did have one other option. I could pick up and leave, which just so happened to be my favorite of the options and the one I was most proficient at. Whenever I had been confronted with something awful, I picked up and left. Parents die? Bon voyage. Get dumped? See ya. My sister called it arrivederci syndrome. Speaking of which, that's where I would go. I could pack up and be in France in less than a day. But I was sick of thinking. I just wanted to turn my brain off for a couple hours.